Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the latest edition of Craig Houston Talks To. And in this edition, we've got well-known journalist Gary Ralston. Gary, thanks for coming in.
No worries at all, Craig. And it's great to be back to where it all started for me at Fir Hill.
In what way?
Well, my claim to fame is that I became, in 1983, the youngest player ever to sign for Partick Thistle. So there you go. I've still got the Evening Times clipping. Eddie McCulloch, the chief scout, says, "We've signed the new Mo Johnson." And you want to know something? About 6 months later, I was selling knockoff tracksuits for the back of a van as well. So obviously, I never made it here as a player, but it's lovely to return to the old stadium and speak to your good self.
And what, when you say the youngest, what age were you?
I was only 13. Remember, this was the day before Pro Youth, you know, so it was S-forms, and you had to be 13 to sign an S-form. So I think I was about a month, September 83. My birthday was July, so that was the headline at the time. Thistle make their youngest ever signing. But as you probably well know from your own experience, Scottish youth football back in that stages, it was far less structured than it was these days. You know, but I do remember getting £3 a week in expenses, and Davy Moyes Senior coming up to my house just up the road in the mountain to give me 16 weeks of wages that hadn't been paid. So it was fish suppers all round that night.
Well, like a millionaire with 16 weeks worth of wages.
Unbelievable, coming for the mountain with 48 quid. I was ready to move to Las Vegas.
So. Normally we'll just start in chronological order, so we've jumped a wee bit ahead. So introducing yourself, Gary, a wee bit about where you were maybe brought up, and, you know, your early years up to you started getting involved with journalism.
As I said, I come just from up the road there, and up the road in the mountain. Football crazy as a kid, as most of us were, and I had a yearning if I couldn't be a football player, then the next best thing to do was to write about it. And so when I was 17, end of my fifth year, I had a previous wee stint as a childhood actor as well on the BBC. So it was kind of acting or kind of media journalism, and I decided to go into the journalism world, get my degree through, still in university. And from that 4 years, my first job was the first full time job that I had was with the Rangers News back in the early 90s. Great, and a really great education and sports journalism, as the Rangers News and the Celtic View were for young journalists at the time.
Can he not drag you back to this child actor career? What happened there, Gary?
Listen, well, I tell you, as I said, just up the road, we went to school, and my school was Colson Secondary. Unfortunately, long since gone, housing in its place, suspicious fire, burned the old A block down there. I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with that narrative as well. But one day, a woman appeared at the school, Margie Barber. She was a director from the BBC, and she said, "We're casting for a play in BBC for BBC National Television, you know, the 10 past 5 slot, the kind of Grange Hill slot." And she says, and so we need a kind of untried Glasgow actor. And so it was like, do you know, it was the football equivalent of going from the preliminary rounds of the Champions League all the way to the final and then getting to lift the trophy, because she was going around all these Glasgow schools and one by one, oh, we like you, come back. And then eventually they said, do you fancy, you know, the role's yours. So me and my old mum, God love her, we get 3 weeks in London to rehearse this play, which was called Sticks and Stones. And I'll never forget, my mum was delighted, because one of the weeks we had to rehearse, and it was at the North Acton Rehearsal Rooms, which was owned by the BBC, and we were rehearsing next door to Open All Hours. So every day we were sitting down for lunch with David Jason and Ronnie Barker. So it was great. My mum loved it. And when we were doing a week of filming in the BBC studios, as they were at the time, Top of the Pops was getting recorded next door. Tucker's Luck met Todd Carty from Grainshill as well, and a week out in the road filming as well around White City, around about Wormwood Scrubs. So it was great, and it was shown, you know, edited, cut, and put on about 9 months later. And it was introduced at 5:10 by a guy called Philip Schofield in Gordon the Gopher, and I often wonder what happened to the guy Schofield, eh? So that was me, and did wee bits of acting when I was a kid, which was all, you know, great fun. I was about 15, 16, and did it for a couple of years, the usual. It's like River City these days, kind of wee bits and Taggart and stuff like that. I didn't play a dead body, unfortunately, and other wee bits and pieces. But then, as I said, come the end of my fifth year at school, 16, 17, it kind of crossroads. And I really decided, I had my heart set in going to Stirling University. It's the area in which I still love, just because, the you know, it was far enough away from home to be close enough to it. Away up there to study and just follow my love of football and writing.
So you were studying, what was it, a course in journalism?
Film and media studies was the degree up there. A really popular course, and has produced quite a lot of decent people from it. So it was very highly rated. As I said, from there I got my first break, and that was in the Rangers News back in 1991. It was Greggy, John Gregg, that interviewed me for the job, and so it was Greggy that offered me my first job in journalism.
That must have been a nervous interview for a Rangers fan.
I know, exactly, you know, and I still have images of Greggy sitting there. He'll love me for saying this, but sitting with his feet up on the table. Not when he was interviewing me, but he would come in when he was bored, because he was still involved in the kind of commercial side. And whenever he had a fly 10 minutes, he would always come in and pinch one of Donna or Secretary's cigarettes and sit with his feet up on the table and regale us with tales of his glorious past. So what an education that was as well for a blue nose. It was fabulous.
So how long were you at the Rangers News?
I was at the Rangers News for about 2 years, and it coincided fortuitously with that brilliant 92-93 season. So I got to cover that first season in the Champions League. Because I come from this kind of north side of the city, I was pally and played in the same Glasgow schoolboy side as Gary McSwiggan in Glasgow West. And so to see Swiggy going on and making a name for itself at that level filled me with absolute pride. But it shows you as well, Craig, just how much the media has changed. Do you know, and I reflect back on this and think of how fortunate I was actually in the team bus the night Rangers played CSKA Moscow in Bochum. The morning of that game, I'll never forget it, because I'm working for the Rangers News. And so Walter says, right, come in the team bus. And in the morning of the game, the players were supposed to go for a leg stretch. We were staying, if I remember, in the Sheraton Hotel at Essen, and the players were supposed to go for a leg stretch at a local sports stadium. And when the bus turned up, there was nobody there to open it, and the gate was padlocked. And so Walter, you know, wasn't happy, let's just say. And so the team bus just turned around, went back to the hotel. And so on the day of that game, because players sometimes like a wee loosen up, a wee limber, the players just loosened up for that game, which we won 1-0. Remember Ian Ferguson's strike, played in Germany, because obviously Moscow was snowbound at the time. The pre-match build-up to that game was in a wee square of grass in front of that Essen Hotel, Sheraton Hotel in Essen. And from that team went on to get a result, which I think really kind of set the standard for that season. And the thing that I remember about the team bus was just the absolute privilege of being there. I can still remember John Brown, the song, I'm convinced it was Honky Tonk Woman by the Rolling Stones, was being blaring out from the speakers, and Bomber was up banging the ceiling, whoa, 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 whoa. And I tell you, I was on the verge of saying to Walter, you know, I was, never mind, the players getting pumped up. I was getting pumped up myself. I was always ready to ask Walter and Archie if they'd give me a set of boots and put me on the bench. It was but a wonderful experience, you know.
This is before the game.
It's before the game, aye. You know, just going through all the crowds, just kind of going through the crowds, going into the stadium. You know, the players are getting psyched up. And as I say, that was Bomber, you know, just, you know what Bomber's like. I love him, my favourite Rangers player ever. But he was just, you know, just getting up for it, you know, when it was Honky Tonk Woman by the Rolling Stones that was going large in the background. Amazing.
You said you were there for 2 years?
About 2 years then, yeah. That's great.
You've been what, 22 then?
21, 22. And you know, Craig, I've reflected on this, and maybe only recently now that I'm in my early 50s myself, we used to do a thing every week in the programme. I'm not saying it was my idea, but I thought, you know, how do we liven up the programme? So I made a point every week of going and interviewing an old Rangers player, you know, and just sitting down and getting their stories. And I was thinking back the other day, and it was players like George Young, mm-hmm. Ben Woodburn, you know, Willie Woodburn, Tiger Shaw, Adam Little, Jim Baxter.
Brilliant.
So probably the last interviews that those guys, and I remember them going to interview Wally Woodburn in Edinburgh, lovely home, him and his missus, and Ben was just kind of on the cusp there of dementia, but there were still real moments of clarity there, you know, just talking about his career and what have you, and before sadly he would, you know, slip again and lose his train. But it was an absolute privilege. George Young, went to see him at Grangemouth, and I don't know if a lot of people don't know that George was kind of estranged from Rangers for a number of years. Bob Riley was a commercial manager at the time. Bob says, here, listen, Gary, take up some kind of crystal chandelier or whatever. No, a chandelier, yeah, crystal glasses or whatever, decanter, you know, with the Rangers crest on it. You know, take them to George, bottle of whiskey or whatever it was. And George was in a wheelchair, and his speech was quite poor at the time. Sadly, he died shortly afterwards. But I like to think that we played a wee part in kind of healing a bit of the wounds. The very fact that he'd agreed to speak to me as well was great, because, as I said, there was an estrangement between George and Rangers at the time. I don't know the context of the background of it, but it was quite humbling to be part of that kind of you know, that healing process. I hope, maybe, because I think he enjoyed speaking and regaling us with his times, you know.
Aye. And also for these guys, if it's towards the end of their lives, unfortunately, and it probably was up for a lot of them the last time somebody sat them down,
aye,
there'd be things getting committed to record that would maybe never have got committed to record if that project hadn't taken place.
And I would love to go back and look at those programmes. As I say, the matchday programmes from the 92-93 season, there may not be one there, although I think it was the previous season, just before I joined, is that Rangers were, I'm sure they were playing Aberdeen, and it might have been that that 91 game, the league decider. And I know that a week or so before the game, the editor, and I'm not going to name him, but still a pal of mine, he get in touch, a London marketing company get in touch with him and says, look, we'd like to put an advert in your matchday programme. So he's like, no problem at all. He says, you know, the rates, whatever it is, £1,500 plus VAT. No problem at all. We'll send up the artwork. So artwork came up, you know, page 9 or whatever it was of the programme, and he put it in, no problem. Whether he thought about it or not, I don't know. The programme was printed, usual, but 10, 12, 13,000 copies of the programme at that time were printed, and they always arrived on a Friday afternoon. So the copies arrived, and you always put them out to the executive board. You know, Campbell and all that was always very keen. Campbell Ogilvie, always very keen to see the programming. So he took the programme over to Campbell, and Campbell's the most placid, mild-mannered, evenly-tempered man you've ever met. He was going mental. What's this on page 9? What's this on page 9, he's saying. And he says, oh, it's an advert. Says, have you seen the advert? It was for the Robbie Coltrane movie that he just put out at the time, The Pope Must Die. So that comes, this must be pulled. So the word came down from on high. So every single one of those 13,000 copies was pulped, but I know that there are still one or two of them in existence. They must be worth a fortune. And the very next day, there was a program shortage because, you know, obviously we couldn't get another 12 or 13,000 printed. You know, they could only print a couple of thousand copies. So people said, hey, why can I know about it? Oh, sorry, must be the demand of the game. But that's what it was, the Robbie Coltrane movie. The Pope Must Die. Imagine taking the advert for that. Eh?
Well, to be fair, they probably just got it for the production company or something, never gave it too much. But you would have thought somebody would have noticed. It was
sharp-eyed, and they would have got a story out of it, because I think the record did pick up in the story, but they would have got the story one way or the other. You know, either Rangers knocked back the advert or the advert appeared. So there was always a few moments to be fair,
see, for 1,500 quid or whatever it was at the time, if that had went into the mainstream media at the time, you couldn't have bought the adverts for that.
I think Rangers declined to comment or deny that it had happened, but take it from me, it did happen, you know. But
you'll know when this goes out, have loads of people going into their wee box of programmes looking for that one. See if what's on page 9.
Listen, you know, it was unlike today when obviously particularly the major clubs have got much bigger media teams. I know they probably still know the sizes that they would like, but you know, there were two or three of us operating out the wee office at the back of the government at Argyle House. So, you know, we would make mistakes or mistakes would slip through all the time. You know, I remember Willie Johnston, you know, a biography of Willie Johnston. Instead of Lahore Miners Welfare in Fife, we had them as Lahore Miners Welfare, you know, for India. You know, Richard Gough's favourite musician was John Arma Trading rather than Joan, you know. But these things happen. I worked for the Daily Express and I remember filing a match report by copy taker, you know, when you used to have to pick up the phone and you would speak to someone down in England, you know, and they would be typing your words as you're speaking it, and in the fifth minute, blah, blah, blah. And the next day it was a Rangers game at Morton. I remember it was a testimonial, a pre-season friendly, and McCoist had popped up with a couple of goals, 3-1-1 for Rangers or whatever it was. It was one of the boy Bogue, I think, that played for Morton. And the next day in the Express, it was Ali McCoist, but Ali was spelled A-L-I. So it was our new, the new Rangers Middle East striker, Ali McCoist.
You know? Ali Bin McCoist.
Aye. Listen, I'm no hogging it. The best one of that was there was an old, you remember that Rangers had a PR executive way back in the day, very controversial figure. I know Alec Ferguson ripped him to shreds in his autobiography, Willie Allison. Willie's brother, Bobby Allison, was the evening news reporter through in Edinburgh, or he worked through there, and he couldn't pronounce his R's. So he was, basically his patch was Hibs, and Hibs had played one game in the early 70s, and he was on his copy taker, and he's given him the match report. And at the end, it was an English woman, she says to him, okay, Bobby, that's lovely. I just need your man of the match now. And so Bobby's saying, he says, Jimmy O'Rourke. And she's saying, sorry, love. He says, Jimmy O'Rourke. And she's saying, yeah, I've got the Jimmy. What's the surname, love? He said, O'Rourke, O'Rourke. Oh, for orange, a port for fire. Oh, for orange. She says, I'm sorry, love. He said, oh, for orange. She said, I can't make it out. Oh, for a port for you. Oh, port for you. Oh, for orange. And she said, I can't make it out. And he told her, just said, oh, fuck it. He says, make it Pat Stanton.
Did he take a bottle of champagne back off him?
Brilliant. Bobby Allison was great. It was a great doyen. I loved him to bits. Ian Paul, known as Dino, he used to be a great Dean Martin fan, and Ian wrote for the Herald for many years. Ian said the story once about how he was at the press club in Glasgow. He turned up near Christmas for a drink one evening to find Bobby and his missus all dolled up. And he says, Bobby, he says, you're looking great. He says, where are you off to? And Bobby says, I'm going to Awaden. And he says, great. He says, who's getting married? He says, no. He says, not Awaden. He says, Awaden. Awaden and his wonderful wamp. He was off to the press fund pantomime. So there you go.
So, well, see the couple of years you're in the Rangers news as a young budding journalist. What was your highlight at that time? What would be your favourite event or memory from that time?
I think for me, growing up in a Rangers fans, it was, and even at that stage, you knew that it was a special team. You know, that 92-93 team are for me that still my favourite Rangers team of all time. And getting just to touch the cloth in them, if you like, and just be in the fringes of that season in a very, very small way was exceptional. I mean, I remember, you know, Walter used to, as soon as first, obviously with Walter, and then Walter continued the tradition. they're taking them to Il Chioco, you know, up in the Tuscan Hills, which was a magnificent, I mean, it's a Marriott resort now.
Did you get to it? Yeah,
I did. I went out a couple of times, and honestly, Goffey had said that the team that drinks together wins together. I'm not sure you would get away with that these days, but I know exactly what he means, because again, we were allowed to go. Walter worked him like Trojans for the 5 or 6 days. It was a Saturday to Saturday trip, and Walter worked him so hard. I mean, these boys were out 2 and 3. I mean, their fitness was really set from those sessions, you know, 2-3 sessions at altitude as well. But he always gave them the Friday night off. And they always went to two places. They always went to the Apple Bar, and they always went to the Skylab, I think it was called, which was the nightclub. And there were two great guys at Il Chioco. I saw them in Parma a few years ago when Advocat was the manager. They were still turning up to support Rangers, called Lenny and Bruno, two local guys, and they ran it. And I can never... We arrived back early, me and Michael, the photographer, Michael Schofield, from the night out, and so we were just sitting about the reception, and I can just remember the word going up from the from the kind of night porters or whatever. He says, they're on their way back, they're on their way back, you know. And it was just Lenny and Bruno and all the staff just running behind the bar to take all the balls and put them away and throw the shot, you know, because I mean they were demons, you know. And after 5 days away, 6 days away, they were away in the two. But Walter was always very good, and in fairness, so were the players. Right, bed back to the hotel, straight to your bed. No, but I think if temptation had been there in the realm of an open bar, I think they would probably still be sitting there till 6 or 7 in the morning.
The boys obviously learned his ways though, because this is probably 5 or 6 visits to Il Chioco Inn. So the first couple of years, he probably got caught out of that one.
Absolutely. And it was just, Bomber, I think the reason I like Bomber is they saved me once from being thrown out the bus. As I said, going to these places and, you know, this Apple Bar, Skylab, whatever it was. I think it was this Apple Bar first and the Skylab. So beers had been downed, and then you had to kind of, it was that kind of induction thing. You had to sing a song. And Ian Durant says to me, right, Gary, up the front, you've got to sing a song. And I'm like, oh, come on. You know, I'm 21 years old. You know, I'm stars in my eyes with all these players. And he said, no, I'm singing a song. So what did they sing? Flower of Scotland or something like that. Durant wasn't happy, eh? So he's like that to the bus driver, stop. It's on the middle of Italy, right? I don't even know. Middle of the night, I've not got a penny in my pocket, right? He's like, oot. And he's the driver opens the door, and I'm literally getting put out of the bus. And all the players are going, aah! You know. And then Bomber steps up, Durante, sit down. Gary, come in. Here's just get your seat. We'll be there in 10 minutes, you know. And that was Bomber. I've loved Bomber, so I owed him for that. Great times, great team, you know.
I know. Bomber was one of my heroes on the park. And then when I got to know him, unfortunately, through the efforts with Sons of Struth, and I got to know him personally, he's a top man. He's one of the most loyal people I've ever met. Solid. Good pal, and I don't think he would ever do anybody. He's on me a bad turn.
Let me tell you something about Bomber as well. In that period, and we touched on it in the introduction. He was very gracious enough to write me the foreword to the 150th anniversary edition of the Gallant Pioneers. John Brown stood up to be counted, and I don't mean to knock them, and I don't mean to be too controversial, but there are a lot of Rangers players, ex-Rangers players, who could have stood up, who should have stood up, and who did not stand up. Bomber, maybe Ian Ferguson, the ex-Dundee United and Hearts Ian Ferguson, maybe Wee Nacho. Yeah. There were very few of them stood up. And I think at that time, what a signal or what a message that would have sent had more of them not teamed up together and said, you know what, this is what's happening to our club is unacceptable.
Well, what happened with me and Bomber? I had asked a few Rangers players, ex-Rangers players, to come and help us when we were starting to get a bit of momentum in the press. And I was trying to get these guys to go and say stuff. And I met a few of my heroes, and one by one, they were like, it's not really for me. And then I met Bomber. And then when I met Bomber, Bomber was working still with Dundee at the time. And I met him at a function. And I thought, I'm going to chance my arm here. I went, Bomber, I'm Craig for Sons of Struth. I know who your son. Could you do me a favour? How is it? I says, could you stand beside me for maybe a bit of PR stuff that we're doing? And he looked and he went, I'd love to, son, but I've already had three written warnings off Dundee, saying things in the paper and stuff, and he says, I've got a job. And I said, you know something, mate? Thanks very much, because you're at the third or fourth player I've asked, and the first one that's been honest with me.
Mm-hmm.
And within weeks, I got a phone call off a mutual pal saying, Bomber wants to speak to you. And I thought, shit, what have I done? And he said to me, I'm there for you. Anything you want me to do, anything you want me to say, anybody you want me to talk to, you let me know. And that was it. That as soon as Bomber came on, Rangers fans would believe him far more than they believe that stranger that was trying to tell them all these horrible things about their club. And, you know, as a man, you kind of beat that.
I remember the record. Remember, I think you were there, the record. I was working for the record at the time. The Banders, Rangers Banders for Ibrox. I think it was a Friday night game against Hearts or Hibs. It was a championship season anyway. I think it was Hearts. And big Andy Smiley let it be known that as a favour, I knew Andy going back a few years anyway. Come and sit with me in the members. Get your shirt and tie on, Gary. Come and sit with me in the members and see what they say. And so the record went from being banned to being right in there at the front door at Ibrox. And we turned up at the front door. Bomber was there, you know, and yourself, and there was a crowd at the front door. And you know, that says a lot to me about Bomber's character, because it did compromise his managerial career. There's absolutely no doubt about that, you know, because he admitted himself that he became that, in the eyes of others, that kind of permanently angry Rangers man, which is a caricature of Bomber, you know. I mean, he's a warrior on and off the field, but there's also a real kind of integrity to Bomber as well. But it did compromise his managerial career, and I think that that's a great shame, because Bomber had had and still has a lot to offer the game, as doing now still at Rangers. You know,
No, I mean, I think people forget the technical brain. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a coach with the successful Rangers under 21s and what has now B teams, and managed it to a decent level. And I think it's a shame that. And I don't say it's a shame he's a scout, because it's a good, good bit of input he's got there. But I think there's probably more to him. And as you say, there's now, when people think of John Brown, they think of the guy with the bright red hair and protesting at Ibrox. And before Sons of Struthers even, I think, came out and told everybody, when he was working at Ibrox under Craig White, came to the door and they went, he's having a laugh. And it cost him his job then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, probably fortunate he even got to Dundee after that. But he did, and then, you know, I came along and he started phase two of that, and it was brilliant. I mean, my favourite Bomber story, I was talking to somebody about it just last week. My dad's funeral was in the members after it, and we turned up and the receptionist, wee Liz, came over. Craig, I'm really sorry, there's a tour up the stairs, because the reception was packed. I was like, Liz, it's all right, we're early. No, it's a funeral, and there's a tour on, and as soon as they get them down, you'll be straight upstairs. I was like, nae rush, darling, everybody's fine. Bomber comes in, side of the mouth, he's grown here bigging. I says, oh, there's a tour on upstairs, Bomber, they're going to be a couple of minutes, and they'll be back down the stairs. It's your dad's funeral, that'll be right. Off he went, right, we up the stairs. Got hold of the tour guide. Aye, come on, big Craig's dad's funeral, come on, as you were. Throw them out, but he made the 5 minutes 30 seconds, and my cousins and all that are at the bottom of the stairs. Bomber's away up there, an absolute Jimmy, guy.
Love Bomber, but it's my favourite Bomber. One of my favourite Bomber stories is the time when they were sitting. It was a steps bar in Glasford that involved Ali McCoist as well. It was running about the Cheltenham time, and for some reason Ali wasn't doing it at Cheltenham, because you know how much he enjoyed it. And so Bomber, who didn't know one end of a horse for the other, you know what he knew about horse racing, you could write in the back of a first class stamp with a bingo marker, right? So he picks 5 horses out of the paper and he gives a tenner to Ali and says, all right, go on, Ali, go and put them on, you know, an accumulator or whatever. And lo and behold, 5 of them come up.
Jeez.
And it was, I'm no kidding you on, Craig. Bomber says, it was somewhat like 100 grand, right?
He won 100 grand?
No, he didn't. Because he turns around and says to McCoist, my 5 horses have come up. Ali kind of sheepishly says,
never.
I didn't put it on. He says, See, I had a look at your horse. It's 16-1 shots and 33-1 shot. You know, see, I had a look at it. He says, they were never going to come in. And I says to Palmer, so what did you say? Thank you, Dave. Just send him in the bar for another thing. You know?
Oh, class.
Brilliant. That's Palmer. You know?
So you've done a couple of years at the Rangers News and the programmes and stuff. What happened next? What was
started getting deep into the tabloid world, you know, working for the likes of The Sun, The Daily Express, The Sun, also had a stint working for the NFL, which was great fun, out to San Francisco, working as a director of communications for the Scottish Claymores in the NFL Europe League, but going out to San Francisco to do kind of internship out there as well, which was fabulous, great insight into communications, which has kind of led me back into the comms world that I'm in now. And then latterly, the biggest chunk of my career was with the Record, which was good fun. Who states? A wise man once said to me, "Look, there's only one way to see the world." And I'd say this to any kid, any young person that's thinking about journalism: there's only one way to see the world, and that's to get somebody else to pay for it. I mean, that sounds very, very flippant, but it's true. You know, if you want to see the world, get somebody else to pay for it. And sports journalism are a bit like driving taxis. It's not necessarily the work, but it's the people that you get to meet that make it so wonderful. And so I can reflect back on my career and think, what a wonderful time. You know, you've seen all corners of the world, and it's been brilliant. You've managed to be at the, you know, in some of the greatest moments of Scottish sport in history as well, not just football. And it's been wonderful.
So how did you end up working? Do you say it was through the Scottish Claymores?
Just through the European League. I knew the general manager, and I got an approach from him to say, look, do you fancy coming in to do comms? And at that point, I was a wee bit, I'd done my 5 years. A friend of the parish, Jack Irvin, had once said that you can do 5 years with The Sun before your health, your marriage, or both begin to suffer. And back in the time, I mean, that's when it was, it's thankfully, I think the nature of the tabloid press is probably a bit less stressful than it was then. So I'd done my 4.5 years, and I was just looking for a wee kind of change. And so that was a perfect excuse. Still in sport, but it gave me an insight into another, into another sporting world, working with different athletes, working for an organisation. I was in New York the other week, and I was with my daughter and my old mum, and my daughter was intrigued that we were walking along Park Avenue, and I says, that's the NFL's building up there. It's the Deutsche Bank building next to Grand Central Station, but there's not a bit of brand on it. I says, you would never know. It's got the five floors up there, but when you walk in, you would never know that it's the NFL, because it's just so subtle. But to work for an organisation like the NFL and see what it did, and I'm really proud, because a lot of the stuff that we did, and from a communications and a marketing perspective with the Scottish Claymores, was and is still being adopted by like particularly the Scottish Rugby Union, and also Glasgow Warriors as part of that, and also in football clubs, things like fan zones, you know, bands playing before games, you know, that kind of idea, kind of pre-match parties, pre-match get-togethers, nothing new in it. But when we were really the first at the Claymores to do that, and a lot of pride that unfortunately we could only put 10,000 people into Hampden, which is still but it's a big stadium to fill. But still, we introduced, I think, a lot of the kind of marketing and comms approach to sport that Scottish organisations decided to adopt. It took them a while, but they are now seeing the benefits of it. It's more about the cost, you know, the supporter experience, as much as just turning up for a sporting event.
What years would this have been that you
had? This was around about the year two, because we did the Super Bowl, the World Bowl in Glasgow in around about 2003, which was the European Super Bowl. Yeah. So it would have been around about 2000 to 2003. Yeah. And it was great to work with some of these athletes, many of whom went on to win the Super Bowl, or a couple of whom went on to win the Super Bowl. I was at the Super Bowl in 2008. When the New York Giants beat the Patriots in Glendale in Arizona, and the kicker for the reason I was there, the kicker for the Giants is a Celtic fan, whisper it, Lawrence Tynes. He'd played for the Claymores, you know, and he was the kicker for the New York Giants. And so to go to, and then to get access to the locker room, wow, 10 minutes after the players had gone in. And to speak to the special teams coach, Thomas McGaughey, whom I knew from an English guy, American guy, who'd worked for us at the Claymores. He was a special teams coach for the Giants. It's amazing. We guys like our defensive coach was a great guy called Jim Tomsula. And Jim became the head coach of the San Francisco 49ers, you know. So there's a lot of, you know, his kids went to the wee school next to the church just after the M8 when you're coming up to Charing Cross on the left-hand side, you know, and you're thinking, you know, that's Jim, you know, he became the head coach of San Francisco 49ers. But trying to take on Scottish football and win an audience in a very cramped environment was difficult.
No, you've done well getting 10,000 if you think about it. Aye. But see, so your career up until then was done uni, a couple of years with Rangers, then into the big bad world, the newspaper world, and you've been around the world a bit. You've been all over Scotland, I would imagine, most grounds at that point. Seen how Scottish football works, and then getting introduced to the MFL, that must have just been a different level of professionalism and comms.
But it was, and it gave me a real idea of how we should approach communications. You know, because we had to fight hard for our. You know, it frustrated me, and it still does, that a football team can bring a cut out of the Scottish Cup and invite the media along, and they're all there. You know, at the Scottish Claymores, we had to. I still remember trawling up and down the Chinese restaurants of Circuit Hall Street to get, you know, those dragons. Mm-hmm. I needed a dragon because we were playing Barcelona Dragons, so I needed it for a picture, you know, so that we could illustrate it. You know, got a guy who was a fire eater out for a picture, you know, because we were playing the Rhine Fire, you know, so we've got a wee kicker, you know, underneath them with a fire extinguisher, all that kind of stuff, you know, trying to make it an event, actually going to the media and saying, look, we've got a good story here to tell. You should maybe consider speaking to this guy. It's a real human interest story here. I see parallels between, and we spoke about this off camera there, that I'm a real fan now of the Rangers women's team in particular. My daughter and I, Jennifer, she's 15, she plays football. And so we go a lot to the Rangers women's, watching Rangers women's team. Should have won the league last year, but don't get me started. But I see a lot of parallels between that NFL experience and the women's game in general in Scotland in terms of how you can grow it. And you've got to make your players accessible and interesting. You've got to allow them the space to tell their stories. And I'm not quite sure that Scottish football clubs are, and I don't just mean Rangers here, I mean just in general, and also the Scottish media, it has to be said, I don't think that there's quite that synergy there yet, you know, where you can go. Because I'm sure if you look at the Rangers team, there must be a million great uplifting stories there, inspirational stories for not just young women, but for sport in general. But one is getting access to it, and then secondly is getting the column inches within the newspaper itself or newspapers or online to actually be able to tell those stories. That's the challenge.
Yeah, and as an outsider who's had a couple of 3 years of dealing with the press back in the protest, that's how you and I get friendly. So I've got limited experience, but a bit of experience of how these things work. And I think the whole journalism thing, I think it's even changed for 2012-13 when I started seeing it, that if it's not a story that's landing on your lap, i.e. Rangers are playing on Saturday, Scotland are playing last night, there's these stories they're creating themselves. For anything out with that, it seems to be a load of people with access to Facebook and Twitter that fill papers or fill digital content and I've seen that change even in the 10 years that I've had connections with newspapers. So is any worry, you know, they're not going to get up off their arse and go to Auchinhowie on a wet Tuesday to see if there's a woman outside there that they can chat to and, you know, fill up, you know, a couple of columns.
Yeah, a Twitter row has erupted. You know, two people say different things on Twitter and suddenly it's, you know, it's in the paper. Or Andy Hardy, a guy that I like, but his missus, you know, is shows a leg on holiday and all this stuff. Aye. You know, I remember
somebody was, you know? She'd ordered the Starbucks you know, and said something and the next thing up was in the paper. You're like,
the one thing I learned about the Sun was a hard school, right? We had a sports editor there called Steve Wilsoncroft. So Wilson's still with us, you know, retired now, but and he knows he was called the Mad Jordan. right? Blythe Spartan fans, never left the office, you know. Used to call him the eternal flame. He never went out, right? But he just used to, it was Wilson that was responsible for things like Tally's four, Wally's one, you know, all that kind of stuff back in the day when the Rangers were getting beat with Juventus and stuff like that. But he was a hard taskmaster. But he put in principles there for young journalists, and that's why I'm saying you don't work for him for 4 or 5 years, all you could take. But principles that still stay with me and with others that I've worked with him still. And I'll give you an example of that, right? Remember the game when Rangers all but sealed 9 in a row, I think 1-0 at Celtic Park, when Paolo Di Canio was threatening to break Ian Ferguson's leg, and Fergie was saying to him, I mean, brave man, Di Canio, you know, Fergie was saying to him, you know, down the tunnel, I'll see you at the end. The story's well told. The following morning, I was at that game, working at a game. So the following morning, Wilson Croft says to me, well, you're just going to have to go to Celtic Park, he says, and see what Paolo Di Canio was saying to this. And I'm thinking to myself, I says, really? Because, you know, these days, as we know, Auchinhowie, Lennox Town, Trinent, where Hibs are, Oriam at Hearts, all these training grounds now, they're all, you know, you kind of just walk up, but in these days you could. So I've taken the bravery pills because I knew I had to do it, because if I didn't, it would have gone through me, probably sacked me. So I turns up at Celtic Park, and I'm kind of hanging about and I'm waiting in Di Canio coming out, back of 12, whatever, and there's a, you know, there's a kind of maybe a dozen, two dozen Celtic fans about, and you can tell, you know, that understandably, they're no happy, their team's lost, you know, the Rangers are going to match their fabled 9 in a row, so they're not really content. So I see Paolo coming out, right? So, and I didn't really know him, you know, maybe knew him to say hello to you. Covered his pre-season when he first arrived. So I goes to him and I says, Paolo, you know, Gary from, I says, can you speak to me about the game yesterday, you know? And meanwhile, the security guy at Celtic's clock me at the front door, you know, so he's going in to tell Tommy Burns, you know, reporters out here with Paolo. So Paolo, being Italian, you know, starts throwing his hands up in the air. This number Ferguson, this number 3 or whatever number Fergie was wearing that day, he's not a nice man, you know, and then blah blah blah, and he says this, but number 2 is Craig Moore, he's a good guy, he's very sporting, you know, blah blah blah, but this Ferguson, blah. And so his arms are going up. So meanwhile, and we're walking and talking at this point, right? So we get to Paolo's car and his arms are still up in the air, and he looks irate, which he was, but not with me. So in the meantime, the Celtic fans, you know, I've seen what's happening. So they've slowly moved towards the car and I've started to shadow it. And a couple of the shouts have come in, effing him, like, what's he fucking saying? You didn't know who I was, just knew that I was reporting. What's he fucking saying to you? And they were about to go for me, to be fair. The Canio, hats off to him, turns around and says, no, no, no. He says, please. I'm speaking to the journalist, you know, and then the arms were up, but they, and then Tommy had come out as well and says, Gary, what are you up to? Come on. I says, oh, they phoned later on. I says, Tommy, there's a gaffer that sent me. You know what it was like. But we got a right good day back page and a spread out of it. But yeah, so I can't see a situation these days, maybe thankfully so, where young journalists would be sent into that kind of environment and basically told, right, away you go and get a story or pretty much or else.
So what was... You've done the Sun, then Express, Sun, NFL. Then did you end up at the Record after that?
Ended up at the Record after that, aye. And just after my stint with the NFL, I was quite keen to go back into newspapers. And I had the privilege, for what it was, of working with over in Hearts for a couple of seasons before Jim Traynor it was who brought.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
me back over to the West. But you know, working with Vladimir Romanov at Hearts, you know, that was always interesting. I remember he invited us all to Kaunas, maybe about seven of us to interview him, and he says, "Oh, I must show you my bank vault," and he took us downstairs, his big headquarters, and down the stairs we all went, you know, and he says, in you go, you know, and we were all shiting ourselves because he's got that, in you go, you know, and he could speak English fine, you know, but he just made a point of not doing it. So in you go, and so I says, all right, and we go, right? So we went in, and we were expecting him just to shut the door behind us and lock us in and just walk in, you know, we would have been discovered 10 years later as skeletons in the corner, but it wasn't like that, of course. But I still maintain they took away that revolving door at Riccarton when they made it the Orion Centre, and I still maintain they should have taken that door and put it into the Scottish Football Museum, because it seemed to me that we were there every bloody week, you know, if it wasn't a manager or if it was their player or whatever, just chasing Romanov or his son or one of his dictators around those doors. It was an AGM, and it was no long after they appointed Graham Ricks, and the Hearts fans were howling their outrage. And we came out from it at the end, and it was Romanov, his son, and he had been just so dismissive of the fans, you know, looking down his nose at them, and the jambos were irate. And we walked out to the back of Tynecastle, the Gorgie Suite, and we walked out there. There's two Hearts fans are fighting each other. There's another two have got the Cossacks, you know, the Cossacks out. They've got and they're setting fire to them. Who's in the corner? The boy from the what was it called? The Dickens Bar on Dowry Road. He's got his Windies doing in the motor, and he's blaring out because Graham Ricks. I mean, it's no funny, but he's blaring out Gary Puckett and the Union Jack, Union Gap, young girl got out of my life, and Neil Sedaka's happy birthday, sweet 16. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if you can't get a story out of this as a tabloid,
those headlines
writer,
all over the place.
You want to chuck it, you know? So it was potty, but always interesting.
So that was you coming back into the fold with the mainstream media again, and your first gig's the Hearts guy, basically. Then.
First gig's the Hearts guy, but the great thing is that you're getting to do all these different events from all around the world. I mean, my gaffer used to come up to me, Austin Barrett used to come up and say, "Listen, Gary, go and do me a favour. I need somebody to go to New York for 3 weeks to cover the US Open tennis. You know, at the end of August, best time to see New York. Do you fancy going? You know, will you do me a favour?"
Okay, all right then,
you know. Or go to the Beijing Olympics, the London Olympics. I went to Beijing, and big Chris Hoy, who's my favourite ever Scottish athlete. So he's won 3 gold medals, first British athlete in 100 years to do it at one games. And so we've filed the story, and we've said to him afterwards, "Listen, can we see you tomorrow for the follow-up, you know, a wee coffee?" And I said, "I ain't no problem at all." He said, "That's me finished now with the games anyway." So he says, "Come and meet me tomorrow." And so we meet him the next day. Now, a week before, I'd been at a press conference involving a big swimmer, Michael Phelps. Remember, he'd won 8 gold medals. Beat even Spitz in 72 or whenever it was.
Was that he turned up with a funny suit? Caused a bit of chaos with the fins or something on it?
It was a freak because in the nicest possible way, because he'd something like size 14 feet, he'd like arms that drooped down to the side of his calves. He had a short body and long legs. So he was effectively a human fish. So he won these 8 gold medals. And after he won the 8 gold medals, he... you know, we were out there, it was about 400 at the news conference, and some journalist for the Tennessee Times or whatever says to him, "Hey, you've done it, Michael, you know, after all this, 8 gold medals, 8 swims, 8 gold medals. What does Michael Phelps think about Michael Phelps?" And impressive big guy, you know, and he strokes his chin and he gives this wonderfully erudite answer about how Michael Phelps feels to be Michael Phelps. And I remembered that question. So the next day, when Big Hoy's won his 3 goals, we're sitting having a wee coffee, and there's only 2 or 3 of us there, just the Scottish journalists. And Hoy's a superstar, legend, love him, great guy. And he says to, so I says to him, "Hey, listen, Chris," he says, "you've won the 3 gold medals, first British athlete in a year to do it, in 100 years to do that at single games. What does Chris Hoy think of Chris Hoy?" And he just looked at me and he says, "Big man," he says, "see when Chris Hoy starts referring to Chris Hoy in the third person," he says, "that's when Chris Hoy knows that Chris Hoy's disappeared right up his own ass." And in fairness to him, he started his autobiography. That's my claim to fame. He started his autobiography with a line. Gary Ralston from the Daily Record asked me a question after winning my 3 golds at medals at Beijing that I've never been asked before and have never been asked since, you know.
And you stole it.
And I stole it, aye. And you got to go to the World Cups as well, Germany. I got to meet Dave King at the 2010 World Cup. Tell you this story. I'm in Johannesburg, right? Scotland are nowhere near the tournament, right? For obvious reasons. Hopefully things are about to change now. But anyway, so 2010, I find myself in Johannesburg for 5 weeks, right? And, you know, ourselves and the Irish used to laugh with the Irish boys because we were at the bottom of the ticket list, right? Scotland and Ireland are nowhere near the tournament. So the boys from Dublin and Donegal, they're tearing their head out as we are as well. So we're going to the occasional game at the Calabash, you know, that kind of stuff, the big stadium there that hosted the final. And so I says, Dave King stays in Johannesburg. So I says, I wonder if I can try to throw a kilt on this World Cup experience. Whenever you hear a story breaking, you always say, can I throw a kilt on something? You know, can I get a Scottish angle? So I says, I'll see what I can find. So I was staying, for anybody that knows Johannesburg, I was staying in a lovely guest house just off the Rivonia Road that was owned by an old kind of eccentric English couple called Jenny and Roger. Beautiful people. And they were all into all that kind of bridge playing, you know, and the golf and all that. So they were the expat community. So I went to Jenny and Roger, and I says, you ever heard of a guy called Dave King before? I don't think you have, Gary, but we'll ask around the circle. So sure enough, within half a day, they've come back and said, oh, yes, you know. I says, you got an address? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Dave stays at number 39 Joe Bloggs Road, whatever the address was. It turns out it's the most exclusive, obviously, area of Santon. So part of the deal in sending me to the World Cup is that the record for insurance and safety purposes had to give me a driver, right? Now this sounds like, you know, it's somebody with a you know, blue blazer and grey slacks and a cap. It was nothing of the sort. It's a wee guy called Winston, and he kind of beaten up, you know, Toyota Hiace van or whatever it was. But Winston was a legend. Him and I had a laugh together, you know, kept calling me Mr. Gary, Mr. Gary, Mr. Gary. Says, Winston going to stop calling me Mr. and just call me Gary? Okay, Mr. Gary, you know. So anyway, so I says, right, Winston, I says, I've got a job for us today. We've got to go to Joe Bloggs Road up in Santon. I says, we're looking for a guy called Dave King. Okay, Mr. Gary, I know where Joe Bloggs Road is, right? So he's up to Joe Bloggs Road. And obviously, it's different gravy, right? I mean,
does he know you're coming?
No, he doesn't know I'm coming, right? I'm just going to what they call in the journalist trade doorstep. I'm double wide, right? So I've just printed the Gallant Pioneers. Yeah. So I says, right, I'll take a wee copy of the Gallant Pioneers with me, you know, is my entry in. But the thing about this street, Hoostie, is that it's a kind of windy street, right? So it's not like a long street, Great Western Road on there's number 39. It's all very leafy, and at every turn in the road, there's a kind of gate tower, you know, so obviously yeah. security's high. And so I didn't know the number, right? It was Joe Bloggs. All we knew is it was Joe Bloggs Road, right? So we turns up in Joe Bloggs Road, and I says, right, Winston, engine running, just move forward here. Here's number one. So he goes up to number one, gate tower. I'm looking for Mr. King. You know, guy looks down at me from his perch and says, no Mr. King here. So, okay. So then across the street, number two, I'm looking for Mr. King. No Mr. King here. Okay, right. Cross road back again, number three, right? Winston's gone behind me in the motor and he starts shouting at the window, you're doing it all wrong, Mr. Gary, you're doing it all wrong. I'm like, Winston, listen, I'm the journalist, right? You just keep driving. I'm looking for Mr. King, you know, big, you know, serious military-looking types. No Mr. King here. Across the street, number four, no Mr. King here. So, Mr. Gary, you're doing it all wrong, you're doing it all wrong. So he's kind of crawling behind me. So I tried about seven or eight addresses with these big kind of towers without any joy, you know. And so eventually I says to Winston, I says, okay, Winston, what am I doing wrong? He says, what do I have to do? He says, Mr. Gary, he says, you have to do nothing. Just come and sit here. I says, what do you mean? He says, we do nothing. And he just turned the engine of the car off. Right? And I'm saying, look, Winston, what are you playing at? Come on. I'm the journalist here. Well, let's try. We do nothing. And true enough, within 2 minutes, big four Jeeps all appear, kind of machine guns and all that, right? Private security. What are you doing here? Press card out. I says, I'm looking for Mr. King. Number 39, straight in, and say, yeah, I'm here with Mr. King, I'm here, you know, journalist from Scotland, oh, hold on, so on the phone, so he says, yeah, down you go. Oh, Christy. I think David...
They take you in,
aye? Aye, so he took me in, and he said, I think he'd bought something like four or five different properties and knocked them all down, to create this thing. So we're going down this drive. I'm not kidding you. Halfway down is a McDonald's, right? Is that long? We're pulling out for petrol, right? So doing this. And at the bottom of it, he's sitting waiting outside this French, you know, chateau type thing. It was magnificent. And I got out of the car, and the only thing I could think to say to him was I shook his hand, gave him the book, and says, "Dave, it's a long way from Castlemilk."
A wee bit away from him, you know.
But it was great. He says, "Look, Gary," he says, I'm going to Port Elizabeth for a couple of weeks. I'm going to see some games and stuff like that. He says, but I will give you a call. He says, and I'll sit down and I'll talk to you. This is 2010, you know. And Martin Geisler, who's a pal of mine, Martin works for Radio Scotland now, obviously. And Martin's Mrs. Teresa, Martin was the African correspondent for ITN at that point. So Teresa, I got and told Martin, I says, I need a photographer. He says, I'm a missing a photographer, Teresa, she's lovely. So she became a photographer, and Dave was as good as his word. It was a couple of weeks later, and he says, right, listen, that's me back. He says, come down tomorrow and we can sit and have a cup of tea and just at his home. And he was gracious enough to invite me in and chat through what he felt, where he felt Rangers were going and going wrong at that time. A kind of good friend. I don't know Dave King particularly well. I've got cards on the table. I've not spoken to him really much in my career. Occasional email. Certainly not since I left journalism. But he strikes me as being a very, very good friend, but a bad enemy. You know, you wouldn't like to, I don't mean bad. I just mean like he's a guy that you would rather have on your side than against you. You know, yeah. It's kind of maybe my hope. I think that, and I think that the signs are there that there's a better accord between him and Rangers going forward. You know, because I think it suits everybody. He's such a significant shareholder. He either sells his shares to someone who's, you know, friendly to the aims and ambitions of the current board, or he, you know, either stays quiet as a chunky shareholding there, or that he somehow becomes involved again, but it's on better terms than it was before.
Yeah, I don't think there are many people would have said that in the Part's tenure that any of it was pleasant. Mm. There were stories coming in, getting planted for one side, and then saying we're not saying anything in the press, and Dave would react, and you're going, I can understand what you're saying here, but a lot of time you're thinking, do we need to do it? And but it, you know, it is what it is.
I do think that Rangers are you might disagree with me, but I do think that Rangers are in a better position, certainly under the Parks and Dave King, a lot of good. You know, Rangers wouldn't have got 55 without their support, without their benevolence. And I really like John Bennett. I see John a couple of times at the women's game because I know that he's a big advocate for the women's team as well. And I like John, and I think that James Bisgrove as well, as the chief exec, brings a kind of enthusiasm and energy to the position as well, which I think will hopefully add it in good steps. And they're making some, you know, they're making some good moves behind the scenes there as well, in my opinion.
So when you went back to 2010 World Cup, had you spoke to Dave King before this? Was this
no,
your first?
I tell you, I'd spoken to him once before. Remember, he invested money into Rangers under David Murray, and I don't think I ever put him in the same room as David. Sparks would fly. He put in that was I want to say it was £20 million that he put in, and managed to track him down with the help of Daryl King, and I worked on it, and we managed to get Dave at the. It was one of the grand New York hotels at the time, the Algonquin or the Warwick or whatever it was, and he chatted to me then. But that was the only time that I'd ever really spoken to him.
And how far previous was this?
Well, that would have been under the Murray era, so that would probably be going back to maybe when did he put the money in? I mean, you tell me. Yes. Was it 2004, 2005? Yeah. Around about that period. It might even have been earlier. But it was. It might even have been earlier than that. It might have been the heyday back in the late 90s. But it was. But yeah, and then obviously, I'm saying no, spoken to Dave, seen him at various press conferences and what have you over the, you know, from 2015 onwards, you know, and he was always he was always entertaining copy as a journalist, you know.
Aye, he knows how to write a headline. He would probably write them for you before he met you.
I think there's some things that he would regret saying. I think that his comment about, you know, one title and they'll collapse is, or words to that effect, I think was ill-judged. You know, I think that just poked a bear. poked Dermot Desmond's bear in particular, and I know that two of them are, you know each other well enough through the golf. So I think that that's, but I think that the money that he's invested and the good that he and Douglas Park have done for the club probably far outweighs any of the kind of negativity that may come around it.
I'm just looking back there, came a director 30th of March 2000.
2000, there you go.
Then invested 20 million of his personal wealth into Murray Sports Limited because they were the body at the time. Yeah, I mean, another guy, £20 million into a football club to lose it.
Listen, a wise man said to me, there's only one way to make a small fortune for Scottish football, and that's to start off with a large one. You know, it's very, very true, isn't it? You know?
Something I learned through that horrific time from 2012 onwards, and I think I could probably write a book on how to take over a football club with somebody else's money and talk absolute shite to them. Because the default setting for football fans tends to be, if somebody tells me something good about my club, I'll accept it without question. If somebody tells me something bad about my football club, I'll ignore them.
But see, I don't disagree with you. You go back to, you know, was it Michael Knighton that was playing keepy up in front of the Stretford end at Old Trafford?
I was buying it with somebody else's money.
Yeah, buying it with somebody else's money. And I think that the financial frame, the financial framework of British football now is such that no longer are the clubs owned by your well-meaning butchers, bakers, candlestick makers. Still maybe the same in Scotland because of the economy of scale here. But if you look at the Premier League, you mean how many of them are owned now by English owners? Maybe one or two, maybe West Ham still. I don't know, but and it's so difficult when you hear of all this money coming in from various sources to know, you know, even journalistically sometimes trying to get to the. But when you're used to dealing with groin strains and hamstring injuries, suddenly being told that, you know, an individual of substantial wealth from the Middle East is willing to invest in your club. It's it can be a challenge to find out just how, you know, just how serious they are and how much money they do have.
Aye, no, but I think football fans. I know, I kind of think Rangers fans are a wee bit away from the norm in terms of believing anything that they're told. But I still question sometimes. I think, why are you falling for that nonsense that you've just read? But football fans in general have got this thing. But you're saying about the upper echelons of English football. I remember talking to a guy who was just about to sign for Dundee United at the time, and I know there was speculation about other clubs that was meant to be looking at them down south. I says, why are you... That, I says, I take it that story that was in the paper about you last week about that other club, wasn't you? It was a lot of nonsense if you're about to sign for Dundee United. Because this was a seriously wealthy club that was just a couple of divisions down. And he says, no, Dundee United are paying me more. It's like, how can Dundee United be paying you more? Some American guy had come in and threw some money in it. You've got the American guy doing it here. You've got, you know, so even Scottish football isn't immune to the, you know, it's still the butcher and the local ironmonger and the guy that's, you know, the local hotelier just filling, even sort of, you know, getting to a second tier of Scottish football now is foreign ownership.
But I think one of the times that I enjoyed most at the Daily Record in latter years was Steven Gerrard at Rangers, in particular his European trips. So I think the appointment at Gerrard, you know, we've all got degrees in hindsight. I think it was a masterstroke, just in terms of a young, ambitious, hungry coach with a good backroom team behind him, a board that was willing to back him at that stage. And I'll never forget, I was fortunate enough to do pretty much every one of those games, Europa League games and everything. And, you know, Stephen wore his heart. I don't make any claims to be particularly close to Stephen in any way, shape or form, but I did work closely with him from a media point of view for those 3 years or so. And he was a guy who always wore his heart on his sleeve. You knew when he wasn't happy, right? But you knew when he was chuffed to bits. I have never seen him happier, and probably more relief, but happiness more than anything else, than that afternoon in Ufa, when the nine men survived to go into the group stage of the Europa League. I think that is one of the most significant results in the modern history of Rangers Football Club. I really do, because that result meant everything. It gave him a bit of breathing space that he needed. It gave him the early credibility as a manager that he needed, that he guided Rangers all the way through the opening stages of the Europa League to get to the group stages. And, you know, I say it in the book, to take Rangers to within being to being one of the top, I think the 37th ranked club in UEFA. And I'm not saying this is a knock to Celtic, right? But Celtic had unfettered access to the Champions League in all the time when Rangers, self-inflicted,
almost 10 years ago,
were out or away for the top league, or certainly nowhere near the power that they had been before. And yet they couldn't make enough strides, you know, that Rangers have overtaken them. That was down to Steven Gerrard. And I remember the first game. This is a funny story, right? Because he couldn't go anywhere without being besieged by Liverpool fans. And that showed you the scale of the Premier League in comparison to the SPFL. Right? So the first game that he's played in Europe, I'm sure, was in, I want to say it was in Skopje, right? And that was in Northern Macedonia, Skopje. Remember that? And so we've turned up at Skopje. And it's about 6:30 in the evening, eh? UEFA's about to have the press conference. We've no got a word written for the papers the next day, so we're up against the deadline because we're waiting in the press conference. We're waiting what Stephen has to say and James Tavernier or whoever the player being interviewed had to say so that we could fill, you know, our back 3 or 5 pages of the newspaper. So we're under pressure. We get to the stadium. There's about 30 fans outside all waving, wearing Liverpool shirts and waving banners and all that, right? So as is the custom, we get in there and there's maybe about 10 local journalists as well. And so they're all sitting down the front. So we kind of comes in the back, Andy Devlin, Mark Wilson, you know, the rest of the boys, Chris Jack and that. So we are kind of desperate to get the microphone so that we can ask our questions. But UEFA say, and as is custom, we will ask the, we have Mr. Steven Gerrard here from Rangers. We have Mr. James Tavernier here from Rangers. And as is custom, we will invite the local media to ask questions first, right? So the microphone gets handed to this boy at the front row, who's there, right? And he stands up, right? And he says, I refuse to call you Steven Gerrard. And we're at the back saying, oh no, where's he going with this, right? And Gerrard's kind of like that. He says, because for me, you will always be Captain Fantastic. Oh. You know, and this boy, we're at the back saying, oh, for sake, you know, and Gerrard, you know, dead humble, you know, oh, thanks very much for that. I have no question.
That was
the
that.
Reporter says, the only thing I politely ask for a selfie after the press conference is finished. And then all around them, all the other local journalists are all nodding as well. I don't think any of them are football reporters. You know, I just think they were all kind of, you know, maybe they worked in the politics beat. They're just there to see Steve Gerrard. But Stephen was great. As soon as the press conference ended, he says to them, right, he says, down here, the lot of them. One picture, me in the middle with all you guys, and they were all delighted, you know, before they went out to the training with the team, and you know, and they got their picture taken. But that was, you know, Stephen was like that with the fans. Oh. That day in Ufa, the game of the day in Ufa, there was about 40 Liverpool fans. I mean, 3 hours east of Moscow, and there's 40 Liverpool fans. We're staying again, I think it was a Sheraton. It was the only decent hotel in town. A nice wee place, but anyway. And there's about 40 Liverpool fans outside the hotel arriving, and when we arrived, and they stayed there during the day as well. And it's to Stephen's credit that it said to Alice, I think Alice works in Formula One now, doesn't she?
Alice works for Red Bull now.
And Alice was the kind of media officer, comms officer at the time. And after he'd done his prep for the game, it was maybe about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he's up in the mezzanine level. He says, Alice, go and bring the fans in. So Alice went downstairs, and the 30 or so Liverpool fans, Russian Liverpool fans that were there, he brought them up into the kind of, you know, the function room that had been, the wee function room that had been given for Rangers, and he, you know, chatted with them and signed autographs and posed for selfies. And I thought that that was a lovely touch. And I think that shows the type of man Gerrard was as well, you know, very humble, very appreciative.
One of the...
But again, one that I wouldn't cross, you know, just because he's, you know, he puts that, a bit like water, you know, he puts that look in your eye, catches you with that eye, you're like that.
Done something wrong here. One of the stories that I can never forget, similar thing, show you how big Stevie Gerrard was, Maribor later on. And I'm working for Rangers at the time, and it was the first European game. I'm sure it was the first one I had to work. I had to go out and help with security, help with some stewarding in the game. And it kicked off outside the ground, and I never ever got my pass.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was chaos. The police, I nearly got arrested. I'm Rangers tie, shirt, lanyard, all the carry on.
No, for the first time at the football, eh?
Come on, you. Allegedly. And it was chaos. So the game started. We eventually got all the bears in. And I didn't know where to go. And I actually sneaked in with a high vis on. And I went into the gate at the corner. And I walked down to the corner flag, some 10 feet away from the corner flag. And I'm burnt out. I've had a shift for hell. I left my house at 2 o'clock in the morning to go to Glasgow Airport to go on this flight. So I'm leaning against a railing. And I'm just end up surrounded by all these Robocops at this, you know, the corner flags here. And I'm like, I think it was either my son or one of my pals text me, "What are you doing at the side of the park?" Right? And I'm like, I've nowhere else to go. I don't even know where the rest of the staff are. So then it was either Robin or David, the security text me, phoned me at half time. "Is that you running it? What are you doing there?" I said, "I've no ticket, I've no pass. I've sneaked in here. I don't know where to go. Come on, run the main stand, I'll get you at the reception." Goes in, takes us up the stairs, and he puts us into one of the corporate lounges. So there's a couple of players there, Andy Smiley and all the gang are there. And you walked up, it was an open restaurant, you helped yourself for a nibble, and then you went up to the seating area, and each seating area had a wee box with about 8 seats. So he told me, "Go into that one, there's some staff in there. We've just signed Barisic, but he's no playing." So I'm standing next to him during the second half, and about the 70th minute, the stadium announcer says something. Rangers are making a sub, and every crowd, apart from the Rangers ones, have heard this guy. The whole crowd burst out laughing. It was bizarre. The whole crowd's laughing at this stadium announcer, and Barrett is just laughing. And I'm like, he can't talk Slovenian or something. I says, "Do you understand that?" He says, "A similar language. It's not the same, but similar." I says, "What was funny? The stadium announcer, Rangers are making a sub," and he's obviously looking down and seeing Gerrard. And wetting himself, the guy, right? Gerrard's on the sideline. And the substitute for Liverpool is...
Brilliant.
And I'm like, that shows you they did not see Rangers. We're playing three quarters of the game, and the stadium announcer, Maribor, can he get Steven Gerrard out of his seat and announced it as the substitute for Liverpool is...
You maybe know this story. I believe it to be true, and I think it was Spartak Moscow game when Rangers arrived in Russia, and they were going through passport control, and there was three or four of the big kind of Russian military types approached. You heard this story? So they've approached Gerrard and they've separated him from the security and they've pointed him down a long corridor. And so Gerrard, you know, is quite rightly a wee bit taken aback, but they're saying no. So it's like kind of one of these Eastern Bloc movie things, you know, where he's going down one corridor, dimly lit corridor, turn to the right and down another, and there's a kind of door at the end of it, and they're marching him into the door. And he's saying, what am I getting into here? And they've opened the door, and the whole wall is just plastered with Liverpool shirts. And the military top brass are pulled out.
I've done a sharpie.
And I'm told he was never so pleased to sign as many shirts as he's having it back out of there. I saw something after that UEFA game that I've never seen before, never will again. Rangers had just beaten their team to reach the Europa League group stages. They were cheering the Rangers team buses that left that night. You know, the Liverpool fans are, you know, we're all at the front, they're all cheering, you know. They'd seen Steven Gerrard. And in fairness, 3 hours east of Moscow, you know, small club, but great wee club. But you know, to have an icon like Gerrard there was, you know, was obviously meant a lot to him. And what I liked about Gerrard is that he knew that not just UEFA, but these other wee places, that it meant a lot to them as well. You know, so there was a real kind of humble nature to him.
I mean, I remember I bumped into him when he was up playing against Rangers when he was a 18th manager or 21st mm-hmm. manager of Liverpool, and my office was right next to the wee changing room.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen them coming in and out, and just before the game, shut my door. And I said, "Can I ask you something I've never asked an ex-Rangers player in this building?" He's like, "What's that? Can I have a selfie?" And it was Stevie Gerrard. I just wanted to touch his hair and that. But the funny thing was, see, like, weeks before he came, I didn't have a clue, right? And I've sent to a few journalists, and I even folk in Rangers. I went, "I've just been sent a photograph of the new Rangers manager and his assistant. His assistant's Scottish. You'll know him. Do you want the 40? So I had three or four. Now you need to promise it never came for me. Aye, he's it, right? 2 minutes later, I was sitting drunk one night. It was a photo of me and Gerard for a year later, right? Well, he signs 2 fucking weeks later. He's like, you're a bastard, you knew. And I'm like, I didn't have a clue. And how, you know what the press is like in the rumour mill, and you know, everybody's got sources and that. How did they keep it quiet?
I don't know. The one that astonished me a few weeks ago was this whole kind of golf. It was in the golf thing, you know, but the Live PGA.
Mm-hmm. How the announcement just came.
You know, sometimes they keep it. Sometimes they keep it a wee bit close. I think that from a, you know, and I was working there, so I take responsibility for not getting that. You know, everybody else, but there's so many different sources now for stories as well. And the press in Scotland, as a result of economics, is no longer the press that it once was. You know, social media has changed everything. The decline in circulations, inevitable decline in circulations, has changed everything as well. So the press, as a result, the media as a result, I think, are probably a wee bit more compliant. No one's really rocking the boat, and I get it, because it's mostly guys, and it is mostly guys. I was a wee bugbear of mine that there wasn't more women in the, you know, in the major newspapers, but it is mostly guys. You know, most of them in their late 40s probably, and you know, a lot of them, I'm not saying that they're hanging on, but it's really worrying times for them. That's why I decided to get out. I took a decision during lockdown 2020, it was the summer of 2020, that I needed to get a deal and just get out the record. I just turned 50 and I thought to myself, no, it's time to do something different, you know, because I had this fear that, you know, you'd be 3 or 4 years and you'd just go through the motions or whatever. And I'm a great believer that failure should never be as frightening as regret. And so there was still something that said, look, you know, go and do something different. Go and scare yourself. Don't take yourself out of your comfort zone. And if it doesn't work, then, you know, you're a big boy, you'll survive. You can go out there and work.
So, going back to the Gerard thing just briefly, did anybody have an inclination in the press? Was there anybody, any whispers coming about, you know, that this was happening? Or, because I remember the day turned up at Ibrox and I just got a phone call, you need to get down to the front door because Gerard's in the building.
I want to say that Andy Devlin had the story at The Sun. Did Andy have the story at The Sun? Was Andy brave enough to write it? I remember being told at the Express that Gascoigne was signing for Rangers, and I was too scared to write it because I couldn't get it stood up, and I didn't want to make an arse of myself.
It's on a par with that, but isn't it? I mean, I remember the Gaza coming, and you know, that was if you were signing level 8s, this was a level 12.
Oh, unbelievable! And you're just no willing to, you know, and it's why probably the record did, you know, wouldn't go with the Mo Johnson story back in '89 as well, you know, because he couldn't get it stood up. And it's one of those stories that kind of can define a career positively if you can get it, but it can also define a career negatively if you don't. But I think that the thing at that time as well is that the one thing I do know about Steven Gerrard is he keeps his business tight. You know, he's got a very close-knit group of kind of agents, advisors, and so on and so forth. And so that, and coupled with the fact that, you know, that Dave and the Rangers board at that time, I think probably knew that it wouldn't reflect well on them, had word got out from the Rangers side as well, because they were keen to be seen as the kind of ultra-professionals that they were as well. So I think that combination probably meant that the story stayed as tight as it did.
And go back to the you're saying there about just too scared to take a flyer at something without standing it up. You were a journalist for a long, long time. And I would probably safe to say, although no many journalists would maybe admit it, you probably do take a flyer now and again. That story.
Absolutely. My favourite, and he tells the story against himself with Big Jim Black at The Sun. Jim's a great guy. And Jim was sitting around the office one day many years ago, and he was you know, under pressure from Steve Wilsoncroft, the Geordie sports editor, he came up with a back page. And so Block plucked from outside of his head, he says, Tony Cascarino, who was at Celtic at the time, is a 1 million target for Chelsea. Great, that's the back page sorted. And a week later it happened, you know, so that's just the sheer fortuitous nature of it. And we've all done it. We've all been under pressure. We've all learned there's nothing worse than a story that you know is 95% right
Somebody gets it before you, or
you get laughed out of court because it's particularly the bigger the name it is, you know, could be set to all those kind of couching terms that we use.
Obviously, you're a Rangers fan, and you've never been shy of that, but you've got to put your professional hat on and write stories. So, although the Rangers fans, particularly in social media, think every story should be really, really good for a journalist about the football club, it's impractical.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been in a position where you thought, I don't want to write this, but I just need to write it? Is there any stranger stories that you were ever involved when you thought, this is a real horror, but
There was a couple, a bugbear for me, and I've got to say that I think that home crowds, especially at Ibrox in recent years, the behaviour is markedly improved. I think there's still work to do on the road. But I remember at Raith Rovers one night, it was a Friday night game back a few years ago, and the songbook wasn't good. Put that on the table, it wasn't good. It wasn't progressive. It wasn't where Rangers should be in the 21st century. It was awful. And I could see the SPFL delegate speaking afterwards to the Rangers officials, and you could see him speaking to, and I knew what he was going to do. So I knew the delegate. So I went up to him and I says, singing? He says, yes. He says, it's in the report. And so, you know, that's a story. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple of times I fell out with the board as well. I remember getting a stinker, a call from Stuart Robertson for writing. I think it was me and the Jordan Campbell from the Athletic at Feyenoord had written that the songbook wasn't healthy that night either, and it wasn't. And you've got people who are saying, and this is no long after Rangers have had their stand closed down, you know. As I said, hats off. I think the atmospheres at Ibrox, particularly during the European games last season, was brilliant. And I like to think that we're moving on as a society, as a support. And it's not just Rangers that have got the issues. But there are some times when you've got to be professional, you know, in terms of reporting what you hear. Ultimately, it's no Rangers that are paying my wages. It was Reach PLC, you know, and so sometimes it becomes a question of it was a story. And I have to say that there was other guys in the press box that night who also heard it, but who chose not to write it. And that's fine, that's fair. But I thought it was appropriate and right that we did, and because Jordan Campbell had Twitter on that, didn't he? He got the stick for it.
So was this the Raith Rovers or the Feyenoord you're talking
about? This was
about?
The Feyenoord one, you know.
I was at that. I was working that game as well, but I can't remember too much of the singing because I was getting attacked by Feyenoord fans.
It was horrible. We got attacked after the game as well.
I was in the pub. You remember?
I mean, if you're looking, that's right. Aye, but if you're looking for sympathy, you'll find it between shit and syphilis and a dictionary. You know what I mean? Somebody's paying you to go to watch Rangers play in Feyenoord. You know, that's right. You were there that night, and they cleansed him. But you know the one that was, you know, I'd just gone to my bed, thankfully. But I
went out for a cigarette.
See
that night, right? I finished my shaft, right? And we went back to the hotel, and a couple of boys like half didn't eat. The shifts when they're up in the games is just chaos, right? And I says, there's a McDonald's down the road. So we're walking down to the McDonald's, and I've just saw the Hilton, and I went, a couple of pals I know are staying in there. Well, we'll go in for a beer. And as soon as I walked in, I could have split that room in three sections.
Mm-hmm.
There was the journos, there was wealthy people,
the corporates, aye.
And there was a crackpots that I know, right? And I've walked in, right? And I'm looking at the bar, and I went, I think you came up with me right away. Uh-huh. And you were talking away to me about something. And I'm looking at your shooter, and I'm thinking, what a weird mix of people we've got in this bar right now. And then I went out for a cigarette. And there was a wee pal I hadn't seen for ages, wee Doogie. He's one of these just unintentional comedians, and it just cracks me up. So I was about to talk to him, and I was smoking at the time, and a fag. And the young team, a couple of young team came out, and they were like, I get fags, aye, there's fags. I'm like, where would you get fags? I says, weird as it would be, see, this afternoon, see if you get in that turn left. There's a cafe in there, mm-hmm. It's got a vending machine, and they're the same price as the shops here, you're not going to charge that money. Smashing, bagging. So they went away, and me and Doogie's having the third fag, and I'm in tears at Doogie's stories, because Doogie's just a crackpot, a a good sense of humour. And the next thing, the boys are running. Keystone
Cops, huh?
Feyenoord's coming, right? And Dougie's well, he's looked at me. I've still got my work stuff on, right? He's like, you get in that pub and tell my pals. Right? So I'm coming into the pub. I know what's happening in the next 5 minutes. And I've eventually got one and they listen to me because I'm like, boys, Dougie's looking for users. Without trying to, with all due respect, of a journalist or a, you know, I hear what's going on. I'm like, boys, Dougie's out there. You need to go and get Dougie. You need to go and help Dougie. And one of them, what's up? And they've all flew out the door. And then the next 10 minutes I spent jumping in front of a journalist that had their cameras out going, that's my balls, right? It was just, the place just went mental for about 10 minutes.
The Dutch have always been. I remember once doing a pre-season tour with Celtic, actually, and I think, was it Wim Janssen's first season? Anyway, and Celtic played, it was a Groningen-type team, right? It was a kind of Eredivisie team, but it was played for some reason on a public park. These often, not a public park, maybe like a wee juniors park or something like that. It's these pre-season friendlies often are. You know, there's maybe about 200 people there, lovely night. And then round the corner came about, it must have been about 30 or 40 really, really tasty Dutch hooligans, you know. And at the end, and they were real menacing behind the Celtic bench and that, you know. And I don't know if they were supporters of the team that Celtic were playing. But one of the reasons that I've got great respect also for Malky Mackay is because at the end of the game, they made a charge for the Celtic players, you know, as they were walking off the pitch, and the pitch was, they was up at one of the corner flags, and big Malky was right at the front. He was throwing punches at them. He was taking nothing from them, you know. Yeah. And I would have been the same, you know, scarping for the dressing rooms. Big Malky was leading for the front, you know, giving as good as he got. And I thought, here, big man, you'll do for me.
You'll do.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.